Hi, it's Jack Layton here. A long time ago, attended McGill and a proud supporter of CKUT, the station you're listening to right now.
Prison Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on www.ckut.ca on the World Wide Web. News, interviews, and music featuring the voices of prisoners, their allies, and supporters. Tune in to the Prison Radio Show every other week on Tuesdays between 6 and 7 p.m. To get involved with Prison Radio, or if you need to access past programs, email prison@ckut.ca.
Rehabilitation.
I wonder if you know what the word means. Do you? It comes from the Latin root habilis. The definition is to invest again with dignity. You consider that part of your job, Harvey, to give a man back the dignity he once had? Your only interest is in how he behaves. You'll conform to our ideas of how you should behave.
I am not a number. I am a free man.
You were a number, you weren't a name, you want to be a human. I wasn't Jim Crow, and hell, I was number 586.
Why do you do a warder's job?
It's a good job. Responsible job. Officers like myself trying to...
Scum.
We're only enforcing the law.
The law. When they hang my husband, is that just...
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show. My name is Yasmin, and I'll be your host for today. We would like to acknowledge that CKUT is located on unceded Haudenosaunee, Anishinaabeg, Abenaki, and Mohawk territories. The Kanyekehaga Nation is recognized as the custodians of the lands and waters on which we gathered today. Jajaki, Montreal is historically known as a gathering place for many First Nations. Today, it is home to a diverse population of Indigenous and other peoples. We respect the continued connections with the past, present, and future in our ongoing relationships with Indigenous and other peoples within the Montreal community. Hello, you're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT.ca, and on today's show, we're going to feature some coverage from this year's Prisoners Justice Day celebrations from August 10th, 2023. So, Prisoners Justice Day is a solidarity movement that takes place annually on August 10th, and the movement began in Canada in 1974 in support of prisoners' rights and to remember all the people who have died of unnatural deaths while incarcerated. We featured some of the audio that I'll continue to air today. We shared some of that on an earlier show that was closer to PJD this summer. However, we didn't get to finish the interview with Rick Sauvay, so today we're going to do that. So last time we featured Elle and Desmond talking a lot about the history of PJD, and you can find that in one of our previous episodes if you're listening to this Prison Radio Show as a podcast. And if you're listening to it on the dial, on the FM dial 90.3, you might want to go home and check out one of our past episodes. It'll be from the summer. Close to August 10th, so whichever one is closest to that day, and there will be really good background information on the history of Prisoners Justice Day with Elle Jones and Desmond Cole in conversation. And we did air a little bit of the interview with Rick Sauvay, so today we're going to finish that interview, and we're also going to have Rachel Fader featured in conversation with another woman who also spent time inside. I wanted to make an announcement about an event that took place. It was last Friday. It was put on by Solidarities Across Borders, and it was called Free the Detainees, Status for All, Art Making and Letter Writing. It was a night in solidarity with the Laval Migrant Prison Detainees. So it was a night of art making and letter writing in solidarity with the Laval Migrant Prison. For over a week, detainees have carried out a hunger strike at the Laval Migrant Prison, While their strike has since been suspended, their struggle to denounce the arbitrary and unjust reasons for their imprisonment continues. And Solidarity Across Borders was looking for lots of people to come out and attend, and I encourage folks to check out their Facebook page for news, more news about the about being in solidarity with the Laval migrant prison detainees, and also about the hunger strike, because for over a week there's been a hunger strike of the detainees, and we're hoping that on our upcoming episode we'll have more information about this. And if, for those of you that are just tuning in, you're listening to CKUT.ca, to Prison Radio Show, 90.3 FM. It's a twice-monthly show on CKUT, and it's the second and fourth Tuesdays of the month. And now for our feature. So this is from August 10th of this year, from Prisoner's Justice Day, Al Jones and Desmond Cole in conversation. And they interview Rick Sove, who's done a lot of work, who was inside and did a lot of work around prisoners' rights and continues to do that. And then there's a piece, another interview, or a conversation that happens with Rachel Fader in conversation with another individual, and that will air that as well. So enjoy. And if you're looking for the full audio from this, you can find it on Facebook on Criminalization and Punishment Education Project. They have like 5 hours of video on there. So if you want to watch the entire thing, go ahead. There's video. This is just the audio. And we'll be airing more of this in coming episodes as well. So enjoy.
But we do have with us today a legendary figure in both prison organizing and human rights organizing in Canada. And that is Rick Sove, who is joining us now on camera. Welcome, Rick, to the broadcast.
Hello. I'm glad to be here.
So we mentioned this earlier in our introduction, but that was a little while ago. So Rick Sove is mostly known, although he did much other organizing, but is particularly known in the law that bears his name in the case, for winning prisoners the right to vote in federal and provincial elections. And that decision is a huge landmark case, not only, of course, of the rights of prisoners, but in the general human rights in Canada. So, Rick, if you could begin, could you tell us what Prisoner Justice Day means to you and why it's so important that we're commemorating it right now?
Prison Justice Day, for me, it memorializes those that have lost their lives inside, those that are still losing their lives inside, families of the prisoners. It's something that I still practice every year, mostly at home. I send some emails out to friends, but yeah, it has a huge impact on me and my friends and family.
Could you tell us about the origins of this day? So you were on the ground at the time when this sort of organizing was getting started. So could you give us a bit of historical perspective on this day and the kind of organizing that took place?
Well, when I got to Millhaven in 79, got arrested in 78. So Prison Justice Day had already started, but back then, we would all just go out into the yard, the main yard, refused to come in. We refused to work. We didn't eat. We had just a demonstration in the yard. Everybody got charged. It was an institutional charge. You would lose 3 days good time, but serving a life sentence, good time didn't apply to us. But the whole prison population would vote. I remember the 1 year we burned an effigy of the Solicitor General in the yard. But we'd always go over the different demands there was a lot of, well, I was at Millhaven, there was about 15 people lost their lives while I was there. over a 4.5-year, 5-year period. And I still have nightmares about some of that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Rick, it's Desmond Cole. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Nice to speak with you.
Thank you. I imagine that there must have been some fear in the early organizing of Prisoner Justice Day of the kind of reprisal that people could face for doing these kind of things. And I wonder, in the organizing, how you all talked about what the consequences could be and why it was important to press on anyway.
Well, we didn't care what the consequences were going to be. We just wanted, we wanted to be recognized. Some of the things that were taking place inside the prison, and just to get the word out about some of the injustices that we were experiencing inside. SHU was still at Millhaven back then, and you could hear every night. My range was 2M, and so I could look across to SHU, the Special Handling Unit. And every night, those guys were getting gassed. There was, you would hear yelling out, so-and-so is getting beat. And they would come in with the big water hoses. And so almost every night at Millhaven, you could hear what was going on. Those guys would be rocking all night, yelling. And I still hear those screams. And we didn't care what the consequences were going to be for us. You know, what more could they do? They'd already stripped us of our dignity. They stripped us of our rights. There was really nothing more that they could do to us.
Now, we know about your advocacy, about the ability for prisoners to be able to vote. But you were watching the broadcast, we know, before you came in, and you saw that long list from 79 of all the other things, the right to vote, perhaps the only thing on that list where a very substantial change has come. And I wonder how you reflect on that in all this time, that it's been so difficult to make these substantial changes that prisoners were demanding back in the late 1970s.
Yeah, when I was looking over rights, what we were looking for is rights, recognition. And I still go into all the different prisons in the Ontario region with St. Leonard's. Inmate pay has not gone up, but the cost of living has. Adequate health care. You get health care, but they've downloaded so much of the cost of medications and glasses and everything else onto the prisoner. They just, I just, it's outrageous they haven't had a pay raise in the prisons since 83 when that pay structure came in. Adequate work. You know, one of the things that corrections does is they, which I refer to as a pendulum swing, is they swung one whole way, focusing on programming within the institution and taking away jobs. So you go into, when I go into Millhaven or Collins Bay or any of the institution, there is no work. So many prisoners don't have opportunities for employment. Some of the things that they've done over the past few years, for example, is they've brought in a new terminology, and it's called STG, Security Threat Group. So any prisoners that are identified by that, they get screened out of employment. They get screened out of programming. They get screened out of, and corrections doesn't have anything to help those that have had gang affiliation to get away from it. But there's so many guys prisoners that aren't gang members, but have that label put on them. And when I first heard that security threat group, I thought, Jesus, this sounds like terrorism. What a horrible thing to say to somebody. That makes it sound like a terrorist. And then I looked at my own parole papers, because I'm still on late parole, and I noticed that I'm down as STG, but inactive. And I, how the hell did I come up with that? I've been out of prison since I got parole in 95. How did I get labeled as STG? And so when I go, some of the things that I've done over the years is I developed a program, a group it's called Breakaway and it was the prisoners that asked me to do this. And so I've delivered that in the max and the medium and then the minimums. And it was shocking going back in and seeing the new max in Collins Bay. Oh my God. When I went in and saw that, I was completely shocked. I think it's cruel and unusual punishment, that unit. I think it should be shut down. There's no employment for any of the guys in there. It's barbaric the way that unit is. What I saw, I believe it was barbaric going in there. They've got a little wee exercise yard. At least when I was in Millhaven, we had exercise yard and stuff like that. We even had a hockey rink at one point, and then that all got taken away. But when I went in and saw how little space there was in the exercise yard and the segregation where one unit can't be with another unit. And they've done that whole divide and conquer thing to the extreme. But yeah, there's, when I first started working with Lifeline in 99, I started actually the end of 98, I got hired. I was always going in trying to encourage, so many of the men to try and move forward and not. And now I go in and I see guys that I've been working with for 24 years that are still inside. I was just in Bath the other day, last week, doing a group in there. And some of the men that I was talking to, I know they're going to die in prison. And over the years, I've seen more and more of the clients that I've worked with have passed away inside. And it's disheartening.
Rick, we have a couple of more questions for you, and then we are going to move to an interview from Collins Bay that was conducted earlier on. But I wanted to ask you, what motivated you to take on this case for voting, which took many, many years? You said you got parole in 95, and that decision came around in, 2002, I believe. So it was a very, very long fight that you undertook. So what made you want to keep fighting for that? And how did your organizing begin? What really shaped you to make sure that you were continuing to organize for people who are incarcerated?
So we actually went to the Supreme Court of Canada twice on that case. So it started in 1983 when the charter came in, and I saw that the charter said that all Section 3 of the charter said all citizens have the right to vote. I was sentenced to a life sentence, but I did not lose my citizenship. And so the things that affected my family and the community still affected me while I was inside. I had my daughter was 4 years old when I went to prison. So education, health care, my parents were getting older. My sister was in the Air Force. So all those kinds of things still applied to me while I was inside. And while I was inside, it was the injustices that I was seeing. And so when I saw that all citizens had the right to vote, I reached out to Fergus O'Connor, Chip O'Connor, and said that I wanted to challenge the right to vote. And so what we had to do is I had to write a letter to the warden, the commissioner, and the Justice Department, and say, what provisions are you going to make for me to be able to vote? So it had to get turned down before we could start it. So once they said, no, you don't have the right to vote, then we took it to court. And so the first time we went to court, it was a trial in Ottawa, and I was up there for a week. Worked its way to the Supreme Court of Canada. We won. But then the government decided, well, we can't stop all prisoners from voting, so we'll set up a kind of a moral yardstick. We'll say anybody serving 5 years or more won't be able to vote. So that, in our view, my view, was further discrimination. And so we took it back to the Supreme Court. The Native Brotherhood group from Manitoba, I believe it was, they joined in. There was a number of other litigants that joined in. And yeah, we were finally successful. And I still think there's some court cases that I'm working on a document now to try and get back to the courts, because I still think that there's some voting rights that are a winnable issue.
Can I ask about education, Rick? Because I know that after your incarceration, you went back to school. And I wonder how important access to education has been for you in the many years since you were first incarcerated.
Well, when I went to prison, I had a grade 9 education. I dropped out grade 10. And I didn't want to be trapped like so many other people, that all I had to talk about was prison life. And I wanted to be able to spend time, good time with my daughter, to talk about other things. So I did all my education while I was still inside. Had to fight for a lot of it. But education, my belief, is one of the best programs. Not that I really believe in rehabilitation, but education is one of those things that I believe would be so beneficial for so many prisoners. One of the things I did after I got out of prison is I worked in Toronto, at the Toronto Boys Home with it, mostly inner city youth, mostly young gang people. And I couldn't believe the number of people, young kids, that were being excluded from the education system. We had one kid that was 12 years old, and we couldn't find a school anywhere in the city to take him. And I remember saying, we're going to throw, this kid's going to get thrown in prison. He can find a gun on the street, but we can't find a goddamn school for him, you know? And so I know with so many of the young men that I work with had fallen into that trap where they get excluded from school, and then they fall into the criminal justice system. And so I think that should be a big expansion of the education system. I think that there should be internet access for education, which there's a couple pilot projects that slowly are starting, but that screens out so many potential men and women from pursuing post-secondary education because they don't have internet access. But yeah, I think that was one of the most important things for me in my journey through the prison system.
Thank you. And I just want to take a second to emphasize that people may not realize that the internet has been banned for everything in federal prisons since 2001 or something like that. And that, of course, includes basically all post-secondary education effectively, since all correspondence is now online. But it also includes things like parenting courses, for example, that are only available online. Many provincial programs that are sometimes required for people to take are only available online as well, accessing libraries. The University of Alberta, for example, has a very extensive library on Indigenous law that people would like to reference and can't. So the claim is always that it's unsafe for victims or that it can't be monitored. But of course, technology has come a long way in the last 20 years. The US allows people access online. So we remain a holdout in Canada on violating people's constitutional rights by refusing people access unreasonably to the internet. And that is actually a very important issue. I just wanted to emphasize that for people that this is extremely backwards, regressive, restrictive, and unnecessary rule that prevents so much for people to so-called rehabilitate themselves. And we do have to let you go, Rick. We are moving to another interview, but we want to thank you so much, not only for being here today, but also for all your contributions to human rights in Canada and to your ongoing work to continue to fight for the freedoms and dignity and humanity of those who are incarcerated. You know, it's inspiring that you have not given up, that you have been relentless, and that you continue to be here with us. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rick. A pleasure.
Been a pleasure.
There's so much that we can take up from our friend Rick Sauvé, and we'll try to take up in the next parts of the broadcast. He's brought up so many relevant issues, one of which you're going to hear about just now. I mean, Rick was talking extensively about Collins Bay. I had the privilege of interviewing somebody who's incarcerated right now at Collins Bay earlier in the summertime. And we had a few minutes during a call to chat on the phone. I said, hey, we're doing Prisoners Justice Day. Would you like to give a little bit of your thoughts about what you've been experiencing in incarceration? And you're about to hear from that individual right now. I thank him very much for what you're about to hear. See, we're having a technical issue right now. I'm just going to, we may have solved it.
Desmond, while we wait for this, do you maybe want to set up a little bit about how you, without giving details, perhaps, some of the relationships you've had with men inside Collins Bay?
Well, you know, I get calls, Al, often unexpectedly, because of the work that I do. People will find my phone number. People who are incarcerated, we know, are very resourceful, and they will call. And when they call, they might have any number of different things going on for them. And sometimes it's just they want to talk and they want somebody to listen. But other times, there are other things that they are hoping that people outside can help them work on. I see we've got this clip ready now, so I'll go into that a little bit more after we hear from our friend. Sorry, folks, we're just still having an audio issue. Let me carry on. And if folks need a recent version of the file, just let me know in the chat, and I'll be able to supply that. But as we just try to fix this technical issue, I'll just say, Al, that I was fortunate.
Sorry, Desmond, you muted as well.
Oh, see? Well, there we go. I would just say. Okay.
We're now having technical difficulties on our end as well. You were speaking about the resourcefulness of people inside and connecting to community.
And about individuals just being able to find my contact information and reach out to me. And sometimes it's just a talk. Sometimes there's a specific issue that they're working on that they want some support with. And so, you know, I do what I can. I'm not always able to meet the needs of people and to support them in what they have going on. But in some cases, you know, we make a relationship and we continue speaking with one another. Sometimes I'm even able to connect with people's family members on the outside and continue the relationship that way through speaking with family as well. And one thing I will say is that, you know, Rick Sauve brought up the issue of gang designation. And I ask a question about that in the interview we're going to hear. And it's actually something that I've been learning a lot about recently from people who are incarcerated, because what happens is that people go inside and they have an assessment done. And at that time, if it is decided by the staff that they should have these designations based on a whole whack of things that, from my understanding, are not even standardized. Well, then what that's going to mean is that it's going to, as Rick said, affect your ability to work. It's also going to affect, if you can work, your ability to get pay and what kind of pay you're going to receive, the certain kinds of privileges that you're going to be able to have on the range. There are all manner of things that get chopped off and restricted. And of course, you have to live with this stigma, and on top of everything else while serving your time, of being deemed by the institution to be a gang member, or indeed, as Rick said, like the implication even is that you're part of some kind of terrorist organization. Are we ready to try this one again? So those are some of the things that I've been learning from people on the inside. All right, so where are you at right now?
I'm in Collins Bay, medium security.
How long have you been there?
I've been in Collins since 2015, so approximately 8 years now, going on 9.
Tell me about the day-to-day conditions where you are.
Well, the day-to-day conditions in Collins Bay has changed over the years. The whole penitentiary aspect of the prison system has changed. So when I say that, I mean as in before it was men mingling. Now it's boys mingling with men. Being introduced to the penitentiary system in 2012, the dynamics has changed a lot. The population is more younger. There's not enough, as in guidelines as in regards towards programs and such and such things as in regards towards catering to the black populations throughout these institutions.
If you have a medical issue and you need to see a doctor, what is the process like for that? You need to see a healthcare professional, you need to ask for some medication, get checked out. What is that process like for you?
That process is very weary at times. Healthcare is great. We got a great healthcare chief, but at the same time, nurses and other things within the institution can be wary at times. Putting in a request, you will not be seen as per se to that person that's on methadone as in regards towards time sensitives or other medications. So for me, for instance, if I went down to healthcare right now, being a handicap within the institution, they would tell me I need to put in a request. If it was somebody else seeking a dosage regards, he would get dealt with right then and there. So it's just kind of poor at times. towards what they can and cannot do.
I understand. Now, you and I have talked a lot about race issues in the institution, and you actually just mentioned that there's not a lot of programming specifically for Black inmates. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
In regards towards Black inmates throughout Ontario, even out west, even in Nunavut, when it comes to Indigenous offenders, these populations, it's not like Ontario, like out west or out east. Well, east is predominantly Black. I've heard that they have probably the best system down east. When it comes to Ontario, we're kind of shuffling as in regards to where I can say, quote unquote, that other than the ICMP to complete my correctional plan, there's nothing stabilized for Afrocentric Black offenders that we can really relate to, because it seems that we're totally misunderstood. There's a big cultural gap in Correctional Services of Canada, which they're trying to catch up on now. But it's not too late, but they need to be a little bit more sturdy as in regards towards being serious and taking a proper hold on the situation when it comes to Afrocentric and Black offenders.
So would you say that that would be a demand that you had, is that you want to see that kind of Afrocentric programming strengthened?
I would love to see it strengthened, because I feel that these men in here, they're kind of still have wool on their eyes as in regards towards what they already know from what they don't know from what they could know. And the ICMP program is only basically more kind of weary as in regards towards challenging you on where you come from, especially if you're part of a security threat group. That can kind of go down a different road, that opens a whole different door. You're kind of looked at in a whole different light compared to somebody without the security threat group stamp.
How has gang designation impacted your day-to-day life in the institution?
Gang activity, or I should call it gang dealings, for what's in the computer to what's being said. I believe when it comes to certain staff, not consideration, the factors that differ towards where you come from, how you, who you, the other half that are salty and mixed in with the John A. Way of Canada, they take that with a grain of salt at all. They're quick to jump to conclusions, quick to tell you that you're diverting, quick to tell you that you're putting yourself in a higher light, quick to tell you that you don't need to lie to them because they're not the parole board. So it's all wary on how you answer these questions, and it's all wary on how serious you're being taken by supposed to be professionals.
So if you had some demands that you could make of CSC right now, not just for yourself, but for other people who you talk about who are going through similar situations.
Yes, sir.
What would a couple of those demands be?
I would demand, first and foremost, that in post interviews, when being signed up for your program and you have that one-on-one interview to discuss your index offense, I would demand that there be a tape recorder there from beginning to end, because as soon as you're being asked something and it's not answered the right way as in regards towards your program facilitator reciprocating your answer, you can be challenged, and then that can be flipped and bounced to CSC terminology as in regards towards not being straightforward. So when it comes to any and every Black and Afrocentric offender that has these problems, I know a few, this is the number one demand that we ask for.
That's really good, man. I'm going to stop the tape there, okay?
Thank you.
So that
thank
was,
you.
Yeah, thanks, Al. That was a recording of my conversation earlier this summer with somebody incarcerated at Collins Bay, and you heard him speaking a little bit about conditions, access to health care, and particularly the lack of programming for Black people and the need to have culturally specific programming available for Black young men who find themselves there and in other institutions, and comparing what happens in Collins Bay to what he hears are more access to those kinds of programs in other parts of the country.
We are going to move now to another pre-recorded piece. So these are observations on the gains made for and repressions faced by imprisoned people as a result of PJD and other prisoner justice organizing inside prisons for women in Canada. And we have interviewing Rachel Fader, who is from the P4W Memorial Collective, is a PhD student doing amazing work on the resilience of incarcerated women and looking at how, rather than constant negative statistics, that we can and should focus on the solidarity, strength, and resilience of women inside. And we also have Kathy Porter, who is a former prisoner who began observing PJD in the early 2000s. So we're going to watch that video now, and we'll be back with more. Oh, sorry, we don't have sound on our end. If we want to maybe rewind that and try again. Sorry, we're having some technical struggles today, but I think we're ready to go on this clip.
Edit.
Okay. So let's talk about Prisoners Justice Day. What was PJD like back in the day in the early 2000s when you first got in?
It was something that people prepared for months.
Okay.
The inmate committees, we would have design contests for t-shirts. So the t-shirts on the hoodies we were able to make, we would make in Corcan because some of us worked as silk screeners in Corcan. And so we would have design contests for everybody. And whoever won the design, that would go on the shirts. And they were judged by all of us, right? Everybody would put votes in whichever design worked. And the person one went on the shirts. So it was really cool because then that person would receive like merch, right? They get a hoodie, they get some sweatpants, they get a t-shirt. And we really tried to make it so that, you know, when you were wearing your PJD shirt, it was something that everybody knew that you were wearing. And it wasn't just a shirt to people. Like, we would buy all the stuff as inmate committee, obviously no markup, you know, because we weren't looking to fundraise. We just wanted to, you know, have people buy what they needed to buy. Everybody would wear those shirts on Prison Justice Day, and everybody would stay home in protest, wouldn't work. And it wasn't just protest too, it was memorial. You know, we had memorial services that E. Fry used to be able to come in, and we'd have like candlelit services.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, we had a
died in prison, right?
Like, yeah, like we had a bench erected in the middle of the yard and tree planted for some of the prisoners that have passed on, some of our friends. Mm-hmm. And it was beautiful, you know, and everybody would wear that. There was so much solidarity. People wouldn't work. People wouldn't eat. And then as we were sitting in our houses, you know, we'd start cooking around 11:45, right? And we'd all eat together at midnight.
Oh, cool.
And it just, yeah, it just seemed like a really, like, we were so together that day. And we talk about, right? Wow, you know, like, this started in 1976. You know, this is what people do to say thank you to the people that have died helping us, you know, get these facilities, get this, these privileges, and, you know, just really try and get that message across that this is not something that was put in place by CSC. This was hard fought, you know, victories, and even the little tiny steps, like inmate committee being able to buy a microwave for each house or whatever, right? That was fought for, you
okay.
know? Yeah. And
what other things did you know that was fought for, gains that were made?
gains that were made were like, okay, another thing was TVs. Inmate committee could buy TVs for the common areas, mm-hmm. right? We, back in the day, we had food drives, and we would mark up the food and then donate to the community the profit from the food. And so then everybody could order from, you know, a fast food place, and we'd all vote on which place that we wanted to order from, and then the money would come out of our accounts, right? And the profit that we made from that, we would give to the community.
Wow.
Every year we gave $500 on Prison Justice Day to the community, to a charity of our choice.
Oh,
right?
Cool.
Yeah, it was really neat back then. And people were involved. We had an inmate committee meeting every month, and people were involved. They could come to the meeting and we'd talk about what we wanted to do, mm-hmm. you know, what, even down to what colors do you guys want for your T-shirts? What, you know? Yeah. And then slowly it started getting more and more punitive because, of course, we had a big political swing when Harper came in, and one of the PJD T-shirts that were made in one of the prisons, I'm not sure where, ended up on the Senate floor, and everybody had a spaz, right? Because it was an upside down Canadian flag, meaning the system's upside down, you know, not the country, but they took it super personally. And then a couple years later, they were banned. We could no longer make, we could no longer silkscreen T-shirts, and
I remember that because there was.
Do you? Yeah,
there was those T-shirts all over, like in all the men's prisons, women's.
Yes,
I saw tons of PJD T-shirts in the early 2000s, and then I remember here, like there was just a time, probably shortly after Harper was appointed, right? That no more PJD T-shirts.
Yeah, no more PJD. Anything like that. Like we used to take acrylic paint or markers and write on our big windows and stuff, like, you know, about PJD. It was an event. And the people that went to work or, you know, were seen eating were very few and far between, and you know, basically told about this is how this is wrong. You know, you'll always get people who don't care or don't literally don't believe you that this was such a an important thing. So yeah, it was like super recognized and back in the day, and there's been a change.
So you're saying the change was attributed to the like conservative government tough on crime stuff, and part of it was linked to these T-shirts getting out and being aware. So then how did you see like the guards or the prison administration react to prisoners, like for Prisoners Justice Day or
that? Well, it's interesting because the government change allowed the guards and the management to now put these sanctions on, right? Like the government before that, it was just like, it wasn't really, they accepted it as a memorial. Mm-hmm. They accepted it because what harm could it do, right? Then when Harper came in, that gave the guards, that gave the management the permission to start, you know, issuing sanctions. So you would lose... you would lose a pay level if you didn't go to work.
For
you know?
One day?
Yeah, unexcused absence. They drop you a pay level. You could be charged for not going to work as well. Then the guards started talking to some of the women about, you know, you guys, PJD should be about, why don't you eat? Because then you're costing the government money. You know, like putting earworms in people, and they're like, yeah, that's way better, you know, and it's not. It is not how it started. It is not the tradition, and it is not the way it is. So now that was out there. Oh, no, that's a better way. Let's just eat twice as much, and we'll cost the government more. And okay, so like the people in SEG that were starved, you know, that is why we don't eat, to just get a tiny modicum of suffering, to just, you know, say thank you. You know, we just withheld for one day food from, you know, until midnight. And imagine the people that didn't get fed for a long, long time because they were in SEG, and they were, you know, the women that one time, it was probably not one time, but if you talk to the Kingston girls, put in SAG and cuffed behind their backs and their food put on the floor.
Yeah.
You know, that is what the food thing is about. It's not about costing the government money or not costing the government money. Like, it is about the suffering in memorial.
Yeah.
That's what it's about.
And what I've heard from some of the lifers is back in the day, and maybe this was before your time, but in segregation, they wouldn't even feed them like the normal food that you get, like as made by the system, right? They would get like kinds of bowls of mush. Like, I don't even know what it was, but so that was part of the hunger strike, is they would be like, I'm not going to eat this anymore, and I'm not going to eat at all. And then other prisoners would join in.
Yes.
Like, okay, we need to get better food. And then eventually better food was provided to people in SAG.
See, and I wasn't around for that. That was before my time, but I heard these stories from you know, my friends that had experienced stuff like this. Mm-hmm. And that's a fight. That's the stuff that should be recognized on PJD. Those things happened in our country, you know, to our people. Never mind the people that have passed away because of the lack of care and attention in the system.
Absolutely.
You know? Yeah. It's a somber day, but it's a beautiful day too. And it's a privilege to be able to celebrate it.
Absolutely.
You know, and that's what PJD means to me. And even since I've been released, the stuff that happens in the community is just fantastic. You know, I last year I was so upset I couldn't go. You know, because it was my first year on the street after my first year on the street with PJD after coming out. And I just felt that like how many people I'd lost, you know, I counted, and it was like 39 people that I knew of that had passed in the system, you know, or on parole. 39 people, and those were women. Right.
And so what, your parole officer wouldn't allow you to attend?
Oh, no, I could attend. I just couldn't attend emotionally. Yeah. I was just, I can't go this time. Okay. I'm at that time, I was in a really bad place,
yeah.
And I couldn't get out of bed, mm-hmm. because it was just so heavy and so encompassing. And I wasn't with my people. You know what I mean? And so that played into it a lot. I only got out the 22nd of July. And so, and it was just like, oh my God. Yeah, it was too much.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh no, that was the year before. Yeah. Yeah. So it's crazy. But I love that we're doing this, the PJD TV and stuff, because I want to bring it back into the light. I want to be able to see people really understand what PJD is all about.
Yeah. And it's a way of connecting with the events across the country. And also where we invite like people inside, like the phone calls sometimes that will be recorded or messages read or that kind of thing. Right. So it's
neat.
A way of building solidarity.
Yes. Yes, and that's really cool, because I think the breakdown of the system, when they interfere in our relationships with people, they won't let us see each other on the outside most times. And, you know, it's just so punitive, and they're trying to create distance with people. So we're not able to do these kinds of things, right? But yeah, jokes on them, right?
Yeah. So let's talk about prisoner solidarity and like mutual aid, peer support more generally. So not just necessarily on PJD, but also going back to like the early 2000s and then the kind of change over time. So on like a regular day-to-day basis, what was prisoner solidarity like back in the day?
Oh, you know, you still had, it was almost like you still had the cliques and stuff of people that were, you know, closer than others, but we were able to do things together and sort of leave that alone. Like we had volleyball nets. We literally had a skating rink in EIFW when I got there.
Wow.
That was out in front of the duty office. And it was like people, all people would come. We'd play flag football, baseball in the summer. Just there was actually community building things that inmate committee would put on and fight for as well, because community building is how you build the unity, right? And so, you know, they didn't love it, but the political climate at that time was such that it's like, this is rehabilitation, right? This is what people need to do. And so when they're doing things like that, that, you know, we're not doing other things was sort of their take on it, right? Like, the busier we are and the more that we can. Okay. So then when you're doing stuff like that, you talk. Right. Yeah. And people from different, you know, cliques talk. Yeah. And that's how, with unity, that's how it was developed then. A lot less division. And the division was dealt with swiftly back then as well, as far as like from your own community, right?
My name is,
you know, there was rules, there was things that you did and there was things that you didn't do, and they were dealt with swiftly and just to calm everything.
So
you know?
It's kind of like what you're describing. It's kind of like transformative justice principles. So like solving problems on your own in your group. So as prisoners, if there's problems between two groups or whatever, you figure out a way to resolve it without involving the guards. Like
always
rely on the state intervention.
Always.
Yeah.
Yes. And they don't like it. No. Right? Yeah.
Well, the system is designed like to isolate people and invisibilize people. And that's why they don't want us associating on parole, reporting all relationships. You can't be walking to program together, going to coffee. And then even in prison, it's like, they'll be like, oh, don't hang out with this person because they're known to be in the drug subculture or something.
Yes.
So you're not going to get parole, or, you know, like all of those things are not allowing, like sharing meals or visiting living units.
None of that. None of that. So it's upside down, right? Just things that you learned as a human, like to share food, to converse with other people, to get to know different people. That was all just kiboshed. And I watched this system circle the drain for 2 decades. You know,
like, getting worse and worse as time went.
Worse and worse and worse and worse. Yes. And it's profound when you think back how much less anxiety, stress, and anger people got out with than they did now, you know, further on down the road.
I bet. I can't imagine for a couple decades, because I noticed it just over the course of 4 years. So
right?
For example, the family day socials where they would have it, I know they used to have it like 4 times a year. When I was there, they were doing it 2 times a year. Mm-hmm. And at first, the first year I was in GVI, it was like everybody was going, it was outside and in the gym. It was a huge event. There was music, tons of food, ice cream, games for kids, tons of stuff. And it didn't matter if you had family coming or not, because a lot of people are so far from their families that they don't have family or different things happen. But they still come and enjoy that day. And the money was coming from the money that people are paying, like all the prisoners, right, are paying on their
off of every paycheck from the inmate committee.
And it goes to the inmate committee. So the inmate committee could pick to do that. Then I noticed each year and actually each family day, so there was one in the summer, one in the winter holidays, and it got worse every time. They were reducing it, smaller, less, like tons of punishments. Like I was able to go to 2 out of like 7 family days, because if you have whatever, some kind of punishment, oh, you're not eligible for any socials or visits, which is just ridiculous. And then they started making it where it was like, if you don't have family coming, then you can't go.
Yeah.
Like, what about all the people who don't have family?
The majority of the people don't have family.
Exactly.
The majority.
We are family, right? We're making our own family.
Exactly.
So why can't we share in this together?
Exactly.
So we are back. That was Rachel Fader in conversation about Prisoner Justice Day, both its historic meaning and its current, the current resistances by women.
Thanks for tuning in today to Prison Radio Show on CKUT.ca.
on 90.3 FM. If you're in Montreal on the dial, you can check out past episodes of Prison Radio Show at prisonradioshow.wordpress.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Prison Radio Show. Prison Radio Show is now a podcast. It's been a podcast for a while. You can check out our podcast episodes of PRS podcast on Libsyn or anywhere you get your podcasts. And like I said, the Prison Radio Show airs twice a month. We did change the times that we air, so we're now on the second and fourth Tuesdays at 6 p.m. And the next Prison Radio Show will air on Tuesday, October 10th at 6 p.m. If you have any questions on anything that you've heard on today's show, or if you wish to be involved with the show, feel free to contact us at prison@ckut.ca. Formerly incarcerated people are encouraged to participate. And folks can also leave us a message on our listener comment line at 438-337-8423. If you are in prison, we encourage you to participate in the show in any way possible. Please feel free to write to us.
What's up, good people? To those of you listening, wherever, whenever, whatever time it is, good morning, good evening, and good night. You are locked into another Tuesday evening with Soul Perspectives right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. Soul P has been on the air since 1994. We bring you all the topics, the guests, the ups and downs, the highs and the lows of the black community here in Montreal, across Canada, and internationally. I'm your host for the evening, Kim Dominique Ferguson, and we have a beautiful evening of music and discussion lined up for you tonight. Keep it locked. You are listening to Soul Perspectives right here on CKUT 90.3 on your FM dial.
Tell me why you're crying, how can it be you? When you gave me